Son and Advocate Mafojan and their team to this meeting, which I believe will not be long, but it would be important that we are really given a short background of what led to these rules and why you had to be taken to court. But I can tell you that personally, I've been part of this industry, and when I joined it, I thought I would assist in the transformation. And I found that it is more difficult to transform. I just recently resigned from the firm that I joined because I thought that there's nothing that you can do. And most of the people that are in the industry are just friends. And there's no intention to develop them and help them to be on their own. So transformation is a constitutional imperative. It can be made optional. So we want to thank the department for taking the bull with its horns. So I'll open the floor to you.
Jay, thank you for the opportunity, and since we have to be quick, I can go now to set it all, if the house will permit. But let me commence by apologizing for our Director General. She's tied up with some commitments, and I trust that I will be able to remotely live up to her standards of presentation, which is so high. Chair, let me say the presentation that we want to present to the House will have the following flow. It will be the authority for the policy, the strategic focus, the need for the policy's content, the policy's statement, the implementation, what about the Master's discretion, Board of Security, the Chief Master's directives, the current litigation, and the tailing of the amendments. The authority of the policy, the Minister is empowered by the Insolvency Act and the Close Corporation Act to determine policy for the appointment in order to promote consistency, fairness, transparency, and the achievement of equality for persons previously disadvantaged by unfair discrimination. In terms of Section 10.3, none of the Companies Act, the policy applies to insolvent companies. The focus of the policy is to transform the insolvency industry. The policy seeks transformation of the insolvency industry by bringing into the appointment process all persons who qualify for such appointment, but were previously excluded due to unfair discrimination of the past. The transformation will contribute to the National Development Plan by growing the economic transformation. It will bring equality and fairness in the manner in which the industry practitioners are appointed. Some bit of background and the reasons for the change of non-statutory policy. In 2001, the department circulated a non-statutory policy directing master's officers with a view to transform the industry. There was doubt regarding the authority for such policy in that the amendment granting such powers was not yet promulgated. The requisition system has yielded no transformation in the insolvency industry. Chair, with your permission, let me just share a word or two on what is meant by this requisition system. This is a practice that has developed over years, where when the master is about to make an appointment of a liquidator, the creditors approach the master and say, I'm a creditor in this insolvent industry, and I want this liquidator to be appointed. I undertake to prove my claim at the first meeting of creditors and then to vote for this liquidator. Now, I think in no more than 3% that those people who requisitioned the master prove their claims and vote as they've undertaken to do so. The reason for that is obvious. Because if you prove your claim at the first meeting and there's a deficit in the estate, you will not lose only the money that you've advanced as credit, you will also have to contribute. So creditors will say, hey, I'm not going to contribute. I want to get something up here. But the practitioners needed that support for them to be getting the inside line and appointed, because the master would calculate the requisitions, number and value, and appoint those liquidators and trustees according to the requisition system. So the requisition system purported to be a creditor's bona fide wish, with a creditor's bona fide undertaking to do as she says in the requisition. It does not happen. They take the right, but they do not take the responsibility. And in the process, practitioners have set up, I can almost call it an industry, of procuring the most requisitions. That is why till today, notwithstanding all of our transformation efforts, creditors still nominate the traditional, if I may, with due respect, traditional white male practitioners. I would love to give more detailed facts and figures around it, but it is total distortion of the distribution of work based on this requisition. And if I may, with respect, refer to what the chair has just said in his opening remark. I wanted to assist with the transformation. I found it very difficult to penetrate. I asked the House, if a person at the level of our chair have that difficulty, what chance does a new person get to bear? The power center of the requisition was the ability of the existing establishment to control the nomination. Therefore, the requisition system presented to us and in transformation efforts a major problem. It has yielded no transformation to the insolvency industry. It has created, the requisition system created an environment which became prone to serious malpractices in the insolvency industry. In terms of the policy, requisitions are abolished. Does it come as a surprise that we find a massive resistance to the policy? I don't think we should be surprised. We are touching big existing power bases in this regard. The policy, in terms of the Act, was then compiled. It was presented to Cabinet. Cabinet approved the policy, and then there were some defects in terms of the technical definition of a black person. That process has been corrected, and we are lucky to have the matter back before Cabinet in the course of the next few days, and thereafter the problems will have been addressed and the process can continue. But as it stands, the policy consists of 7 clauses. Clause 1 that defines essential words used in the policy. Clause 2 presents the policy objective in similar terms as the empowering provisions in the Principal Acts, promotion of consistency, fairness, transparency and equality is a transformative cause in itself. Clause 3, the scope and application of the policy. The policy deals with the matters where the master exercises a discretion, mostly provisional appointments and joint appointments. Chair, please allow me to just interrupt again. The policy focus on the provisional phase of liquidation. That means before creditors have had an opportunity at the first meeting of creditors to prove their claims and exercise their right as is allowed in statute. We do not touch creditors' rights in the nomination, election, and voting for a trustee at the creditors' meeting. The policy deals with the position before that. So, concerns that creditors' rights have been adversely affected, I give the House assurance none of the statutory rights of creditors have been affected. The statutory rights remain. The big issue is now creditors have to assume the responsibility of having proved their claim before they can exercise the right to appoint a particular practitioner. Although the requisition system is abolished, the offices of the masters will still hear creditors from day one. There's an open door policy for creditors to approach the master and say, here's a liquidation or an insolvency, please intervene, and the master will hear creditors. But when the creditors say, I want you to appoint XYZ, we will say, that is your right only after the first meeting. Prove your claim and then exercise your right as you would to appoint, but for the master's involvement prior to that meeting, the master is free to be approached. And you can say to the master that facts surrounding the insolvencies we have not closed access to the masters in that regard. But we've deprived this approaching us with the right to tell us who to appoint. We'll say we will appoint in terms of the policy. We therefore say creditors retain the right to nominate persons at a meeting. The person provisionally appointed is appointed jointly, so that when a transformation person has been appointed in terms of the policy, the fact that creditors outvote that person in terms of number and value does not matter, because that person will remain in the liquidation or insolvency to the completion. So when a new young practitioner therefore gets appointed, such a person will not need to be at the first meeting. My mandate will be terminated. That person will carry the day. The policy does not apply to appointments for solvent company when the voluntary instance of Section 80 of the Companies Act. So there are situations where a company is not insolvent, where they just come to an end and want to voluntarily liquidate the company. This policy does not affect that situation. The appointment of insolvency practitioners in insolvent estates happens in two phases. Phase one is a provisional insolvency practitioner is appointed for the period between the provisional order and the conclusion of the first meeting. A final insolvency practitioner is appointed after the conclusion of the first meeting and having been elected by creditors. In phase one, the provisional phase, the master is empowered by law to appoint at his or her exclusive discretion, while at phase two, creditors elect an insolvency practitioner of their choice. Thus, creditors' choice largely influences who the master ought to appoint. The scope of the policy is confined to discretionary appointments made by the master. Can I try that again? So I am reiterating that this policy deals with the provisional phase when there was an unfettered discretion by the master. The master's discretion was seriously influenced by what the requisition said. The policy says now we will deal with this provisional phase. The final trustee in an estate for the liquidator will be determined at the first meeting of creditors, where creditors prove their claims and then vote on the number and value for their appointment. The person the master appointed in terms of the provisional decision will remain in the estate.
So let me just get clarity here. I mean, this is a key point, and I don't want to interrupt the presentation, but I don't follow the logic here. Should we wait for questions for later? Because this is a key aspect.
No, it's a meeting. You don't have to be a politician if you win.
I just need to understand. I'm not following the process, and I think you are taking pains, and it's not my understanding. But the provisional appointment and the final appointment, I think you need to just emphasize that all members understand the discretion, because you said the provisional part is a discretion in terms of the policy. Later the creditors come and they can decide, but there seems to be a contradiction then, because the provisional policy appointment according to the criteria, surely that stays and binds the creditors. They can't then come and say, no, we don't agree with the policy, we proved our claim, but we want to change the creditors. I need to understand the link between those two processes. Thank you.
The credit practice of the masters was to appoint quite a number of provisional trustees at the outset. In terms of the policy, the multiplicity of appointments will be significantly reduced. Where possible, only one appointee, and where the matter is significantly complex, a second person. Let us assume it's a very complex matter and two people have been appointed provisionally. When the first meeting of creditors then gets held, the creditors who vote in terms of majority in number will be able to add a third and majority in value a fourth person, so that we do not have a transformed situation during the provisional phase, just to find that at the first meeting creditors now vote reverse for it. So the right of a creditor to nominate in terms of value remains intact, but the right to nominate in terms of value remains intact. But those won't be the sole appointees. The provisional appointees will remain appointed in the estate.
Chair, that is helpful. If I might just add up, in other words, you could end up with four liquidators, but sure, that's going to add significantly to the cost of liquidation. Which is another issue. Well, if you're talking about transformation, we need to look at the cost of liquidation. I'm sure you've got great experience in that as well. But so are you saying that in a straightforward liquidation, you could have up to four liquidators, or three, where you take majority? You know, the second part, you've got creditors. What are those two criteria you use? So you could have three for a straightforward liquidation, or not?
Can I answer that? Firstly, whether there's 1, 2, 3 or 10 liquidators appointed, the liquidators fee remains the same.
They share it then?
They share it.
As a percentage?
In terms of our current case law, in equal shares.
That's helpful, Chair. Thank you for that. I won't ask anymore. Thank you.
Well, you should have the right to answer.
Are they all equal? Who has the final say?
In terms of our law, each liquidator has got the same standing and the same responsibility for politics. They should consider the liable. And if they do agree to a different fee distribution, it's a private matter. As far as the master is concerned, they are equally entitled to fee. If liquidators disagree, they have got the right to present their disagreement to the master, who can then make a ruling, and it's normal practice.
Okay, let's proceed.
Yeah, this is an exception interruption, so we hope now you'll proceed to that.
The policy is aimed at transformation of the insolvency industry to root out corruption and fronting, and encourage transparent appointment process. There is consensus on the desirability to transform the industry. Policy emphasizes advancements of women in the allocation of insolvency work. The latter is in sync with the national aspirations to advance women in every sector of society. The insolvency practitioners on every master's list must be divided into the following categories. A, B, C, D, where A means African, colored, Indian, and Chinese females. B, African, colored, Indian and Chinese male. C, white females, and D, white males. Only a person who was a citizen before 1994 for his issue of such a person qualifies for the category of African, colored, Indian or Chinese person. Practitioners added to the list after the compilation thereof must be added at the end of the relevant category. A master's list must distinguish between senior practitioners who have been appointed at least once every year in the last 5 years and junior practitioners who have not been appointed once every year in the last 5 years, but to certify the master that they have sufficient experience to be appointed alone. Junior and senior practitioners are arranged where they fit alphabetically on the same list of for category A to D. Having regard to the complexity of the matter and the suitability of the next person in line, insolvency practitioners, the master may appoint the senior practitioner jointly with the junior or senior practitioner in alphabetical order. If the master makes such a joint appointment, the master must record the reason therefore and on request provide the other insolvency practitioner therewith. If I might just go back to the categories, when work then is allocated, it will be allocated in a ratio 4-3-2-1. So 4 appointments will go to African, colored, Indian, Chinese female. 3 appointments will go to the same category male. 2 appointments will go to white females. And 1 will go to white male. So in essence, you will still have a 30% going to white people and 70%. We have not yet achieved full transformation, but this is a significant step forward. You will see that 4 female, African, colored, Indian and Chinese females, and 2 white females will give you 6 out of 10 appointees will be female, and 4 will be male. That is the transformation effort in terms of this categorizing. Sorry. There will be a proper record kept of all appointments and it will be public, availability for public. But the master has set up, the chief master has set up monitoring committees where the monitoring committee can observe and then raise issues. Initially we thought of having it only at national level, but we cascaded it down to provincial level, so that within a province, the monitoring committees will have a look at the distribution work. The monitoring committee would normally consist of somebody from the Office of the Master, somebody from the Insolvency Practitioners, SARIPA, ABRIPSA, which is the two main insolvency practitioners association, also the SICA, the Chartered Accountants and the Law Society, have been invited to participate in the monitoring. Monitoring does not really need to happen at a meeting. It can happen by parties having a look at the information we display on the appointments. If the insolvency practitioner due for appointment in accordance with the alphabetical list of names in a specific category fails to lodge a bond of security in time, the next person on the list will be appointed and the person previously determined is moved to the back of the list. If that person satisfies the master that he or she has a conflict of interest and which arises after the appointment of the next in line, the next in line practitioner is appointed and the person determined will then get the next appointment that's made. So if you come and say you're approaching it to take this appointment, I've got a conflict of interest, it's not negative, you can take the next one, you will take the appointment to the next one, And these are the type of explanations that will be provided from the list of appointments made. Check that in short is what the policy says. So what you do is you categorize a practitioner and then you allocate alphabetically in there. In practice, it does not make sense for all 15 master's officers to start at the same letter in the alphabet. So we have agreed with masters who start at different places in the alphabet, but will follow. So every practitioner will get an opportunity in terms of the rotation that's going to take place. The chief master has issued directives to be used by masters in order to implement and monitor the application of this policy. There are chief master's directives in place as to how should the appointments be recorded, where it will be observed, and what should be done. Training has been given to all officials in master's offices who will be implementing the policy. Litigation. The second case in the series of matters, there's about 8 different applications currently seeking to challenge the constitutionality of this policy. If you would bear with me, the main applications are for the concerned insolvency practitioners in the North Gauteng High Court. And before that matter could be heard, at least 2 or 3 other groups joined. People like the Vereniging van Regslik vir Afrikaans, the National Association of Managing Agents, and the like. But before those matters could be set down for hearing, the South African Institute for Business Rescues and Insolvency Practitioners Association, they called SARIPA, launched a matter in the Western Cape High Court before the other matters could be heard. The matter was argued and the point was taken in our definition of especially a person who was a citizen before 1994. We had a technical problem in terms of your wording of your definition, and the court found that there, because of a particular interpretation, there could be some person from Zimbabwe who came here at that point in time and is now excluded, and we agreed that it's a technical problem, and we had the policy amended, and the amendment says before cabinet in the very near future then to address that technical problem. But the implementation of the policy has been interdicted until the conclusion of the litigation. Although from the technical point, all the parties are at even that there are real serious constitutional challenges to this policy, which will be argued in a proper forum at a proper place. The court in the Western Cape, by agreement to the court in North Gauteng, agreed to consolidate all the matters in one hearing, which is likely to start on the 13th of October, so the 17th of October, the 4 days have been set aside for that argument. We are confident that the technical problem has been addressed. We are confident that the transformation that we seek is a constitutional imperative, and the process that we are following is above board and is what the law requires of us. We are mindful of the difficulties and unique situations in different estates, and for that reason the master has been closed with discretion to say if the circumstances of a particular case dictate, we may add to the implementation of the next person in line and access the skills of those people that are termed senior practitioners on others. Chair, I have conveyed the contents of the presentation. Is there anything that you said at the
you are coming to us before the cabinet and before the courts may have concluded. What do you want us to do?
Chair, the only purpose of the day is to appraise the House of what is happening in our environment. These are the facts. This is what's happening. This is how we are dealing with it, so that we do not seem to be doing things that you are not fully aware.
And you know, there's something like justice. Justice College. I don't know if a practitioner can get further training there, because otherwise, is there no danger that your PDI will be appointed to quote from my own experience? Where the insolvency practitioner say, I can share my skills with you. I acquired them, and they are hard-won skills. So you can be there, but your colleagues say, no, we can't show you anything, because we will be giving away our skills. So how do you address that situation and without creating a training institution where you can bring these PDIs for training?
It's a very valid concern, and there's a number of activities that are taking place around skilling of people in this area. Although the Justice College is one of the options, it's responsibility on resting on government, which is good to be aware of, and where possible, we are participating. The various institutions representing insolvency practitioners are making special effort to upskill their members. For instance, there is a course on the on insolvency practice that is presented, I think, at University of Pretoria, where practitioners can go attend the course presented mainly by practitioners where the acquired skills can be obtained. There is also institutions like OPLIPSA, Association for the Advancement of Insolvency Practitioners, that have, besides training efforts, also a mentor system where they undertake whenever this newly appointed black female is a member of that and is appointed in a matter, that a mentor will be provided, a mentoring will be provided, so as to not leave such a person to their own devices. Because in an effort to break down this whole concept of fronting, such a person, where humanly possible, will get that appointment as a sole appointment. We have found that our previous transformation initiatives would be to say, you, Mr. White Male, you've got the creditor support, but I'm appointing the new black female as your joint. In our law, they are equal, but in practice, it so often happens that a practitioner with all the infrastructure says to the new appointee, don't you worry, we'll send you the documents for signature at the end of the day, the check. And people will be so happy to just sign off and then receive the check and go. And therefore, even in the court papers of the several years of efforts, they will say that people do not know. We say we don't accept that. We will say to the black lady, here you are solely responsible. Now, when you've done the way you access assistance is up to you. But you are entitled and you are not sharing with anybody this. Unless at the first meeting somebody else got appointed and then a joint appointment will take place. By that time, this person would have been control of the process substantially. In addition to all this, Chief Master has had extensive meeting with the South African Board of Sheriffs, the Sheriffs Association, and there's another Sheriffs Association in the country called the Acronym Immediately. Right? What you say is, you as Sheriff, we will share with you information of what insolvencies are coming deputations are coming. When we get the final appointee, we will ask you as sheriff to join the newly appointee. Go, and you as sheriff have got experience. You must also hold the hand, assist and be of value in this process. So we've asked the law societies, the SACA, the South African Institute for Chartered Accountants, the various insolvencies, the sheriffs, all the role players to be supportive in terms of training, competency building, and so on. Justice College features in a very big way in the training of sheriffs, so that we do introduce the skills into the market, but not at the stage where somebody would say, I'm a private practitioner, you as Justice College, please train me. We would much rather say within the bigger scheme, through the sheriffs, through the university, and other qualifications that can be acquired. I'm aware that people like SAICA and the law societies are considering jointly training attorneys and chartered accountants in the profession.
Members, I'm going to take minutes now. Honorable Scott, Honorable Majaki, Honorable Lagonga, in that order.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the briefing. And the documentation is very helpful. Obviously, this is a very complex issue, and Chair, you also may rely on the committee with your experience in the matters that you have. But firstly, as we know, we're waiting the outcome of a review application. It's just not that one defect. We know that the Judge Gamble said there may be other defects, and there's a whole constitutionality argument. So I think the fact that you have put a remedy before Cabinet doesn't mean that everything is now fine as far as the review process is concerned. And so after the review process, I would think that you would need to visit the committee again once you've got a judgment from those, all those matters as to how you're then going to deal with that. But just on a few general issues, is it correct that my understanding that you need no qualification to be a solvency practitioner and that there's no overarching regulatory board? And surely that is something that we as policymakers need to look at because of the complexity of the matters, and it goes to the heart of our economy, insolvencies, liquidations. It is a concern of mine that, that there seems to be no overarching regulatory board when you've got four. And yes, we've got attorneys, you might have chartered accountants, but a person can start up tomorrow and say, right, I'm starting tomorrow, I've got no qualifications, whatever, I insist that I'm appointed, and join the one of the associations. So I think that is something that, that is a concern of mine. I agree that there needs to be training, I am fully supportive of that, but it, there needs to be some regulatory framework for this whole industry. I might be, is it correct? I mean, but don't answer me now. But, so that is something, because, and then of course, when you read in the papers, and you read the matters of Fidentia, for example, what has happened there, where you've got a liquidator, you know, and an issue of great concern to me is the costs involved in the liquidation. How does one address that issue? We have the shipping of the mines. Now that is not due to the practitioners, but it seems as well, I'd like you to comment on how can one deal with, we have asset stripping, and the liquidators were unable in that case, the miners that struggled, those workers that are not being paid or anything. Why? These are huge issues. So I'd like you to comment on those two cases. Financial, where you've got workers' funds that seem to have got lost through liquidation costs, and the mining issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I've totally been covered by Honourable Sant, because I'm just to just ask a question about availability of an overarching regulatory framework of board, which is something that needs to be looked at. And thank you for actually also highlighting problems around liquidation of liquidation. And the suggestions that you have actually made in relation to how to deal with that. Though what really coming out clearly, because you actually indicated the challenge that actually exists if there is a deficit in terms of the credit. But I didn't really quite clearly understand as to how can actually deal with it with the new arrangement that you suggested. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks to the presentation. I think it was a good presentation. And thanks for appraising the colleagues. I'm generally covered by those colleagues that you have already spoken, but I would like to thank you for giving us this appraisal. I think the initiative is the progressive equality impact on the progressive realization of the of breaking the monopoly in that sense, because it is quite a sector that we are unable to differentiate in whatever. But I think we have the full support of the Commission. Thanks.
I don't know whether you also look on the side of the master. I'm aware of a case of someone who has passed the diploma in the University of Pretoria, who has an LMB, who is an admitted attorney, and who has a master's in law, who is unemployed, and that person says, I want to practice to be enrolled in the panel. And then they say, no, the panel is still closed. We'll tell you when we open. And now these are young people who have qualified, not friends, and we are worried about youth unemployment. Now the qualified youth cannot enter the profession. How does that come about? How do we deal with it? Maybe we should at some point bring the masters here to hear from them. What are the problems? We may be putting a question to Robin.
What I mean is you are colleagues in provinces and elsewhere. Because I'm not a friend of yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if I cannot start with the last one first. I've got some good news for you, Chair. The very person responsible for admission to the panel and the legislator is sitting right next to me. I can give the health assurance that the person with those credentials, if they apply properly, we will definitely seriously consider inviting the person to the interview with the aim of placing such a person on the panel. If that person knows what this person proclaims should surely be placed on the panel. I know that process is underway, but I will ask Secretary Mokhojani, please, that the interview justice rest there. If I may address the issues raised by Honourable Swart. Firstly, I fully agree and fully understand that what has happened up to now in the litigation process is not finally dismissive of the issues between the various parties and the minister and chief master. And we are ready to then address the issues as they are raised. The issue with Judge Campbell was just whether we can implement the policy at that point in time, and he ruled that at that point in time there were some defects that made not implementable at that stage. The whole issue that the jury is out on the other issues in the litigation between the parties. We do undertake to give feedback when these cases have come to a reasonable conclusion. The issue of qualification to be admitted to the master's panel is a matter which is currently unregulated. We believe that there are at least three major areas that needs to be addressed. The first one is the policy on the appointment. The second one would go in terms of the regulation of the industry. And then the third one is the transformation of your insolvency legislation. The process that has taken so far of having the unified insolvency bill for some number of years now. where the legislature pulls all the various companies, close corporations, insolvencies, and other entities winding up and liquidation rules into one act, the Unified Insolvency Bill. The issue whether the regulation of the industry should be part of the Unified Insolvency Bill or a standalone regulatory framework is still up, and we are working. Some work has been done, even if a draft bill has been compiled on the regulation of the industry. Until then, the Office of the Chief Master has set certain criteria. I'm sure if we can offer Johnny will reiterate that when he addresses the House. But in keeping with international standards, we are requiring a tertiary qualification in law or in accountancy in our admission of applicants to the list. But you are correct. If a person with no qualification at a meeting of creditors gets the majority in number and value of supported creditors, and creditors say, it's how many we want this person to be appointed, it will be very difficult for the master to not appoint such a person, because that person has acquired the right to be appointed having been elected by creditors. Therefore, the need for proper regulation of the industry and setting of these standards in terms of risks has become very important. We have seen many instances where a lot of abuse is happening when some of these people without qualifications have been appointed in especially big matters. But let me address that. Every liquidator, before being appointed, must put up security for the value of the assets that he or she is allowed to administer, without exception. But if there is maladministration, there is protection in terms of the security this person has put up, and one could then access the protection by accessing the security bond that that person put up. The problem, which is more problematic, is the cost of liquidation. It could then happen in the process that quite an amount is spent in the examination, inquiries, and so on, even litigation. Besides the fact that we should say creditors should equally monitor expenses, masters also take as close a look at these expenses as humanly possible. There is an industry where a huge amount of money goes missing or utilized in the administration of an estate. It's true. Some analysis, and I'm not prefer not to be quoted on this, but some analysis that we've done is that at least 30% of the asset value could be spent in the administration process, liquidators fees, which is a concern, but that is what happens. When the Honourable Member asked about the deficit in an estate, the Act says that when the assets are insufficient to cover the administration costs in the estate, the creditors who approved claims will be responsible to pro rata share that deficit. Therefore, those creditors should be careful when they approve a claim. They should be careful on how the trustee is permitted or the liquidator is permitted to spend the money, their own interest of at heart, or at risk in those instances. In terms of the assets stripping, there are some advanced processes in addressing the recovery. There has been, especially in the Aurora matter, there's been delegations, Section 417. The Commission has made certain findings, certain contraventions, possible contraventions have been identified, and there's a process of dealing with that currently at the NPA. It's of course of much concern to us. Again, the financial because as I say, it's only in the event of there being malpractice that one will be able to recover. And solvency process is a very risky process. We really need professional, capable, impartial, new group of practitioners in the environment to have proper oversight and proper management of this. By appointing, in terms of the policy, in the ratios that we've indicated, we are confident that there will be a measure of transformation and the measure of supervision and control, especially when these appointees are appointed on a sole basis where they take responsibility. From the master side, we will continue to raise these issues with practitioners in an attempt to address that. We do not see any possibility of doing more than that at the moment. I would say the regulation of industry and the deficit in the regulation and distribution account. If I can ask African Mafutani just to perhaps share with the House, help the people applying for admission to the panel itself, what criteria have been used, and how far we are in the process.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good morning to the Chair, to the Honourable Member. We have adopted an approach that there was a need to clean up the list in the Masters very as possible, and to easily do it in a uniform way, we assembled a team that would proceed with the process of cleaning up the list. And in cleaning the list, we would then start with a national list. Now, the national list invited all role players in the insolvency industry, sharing with them the information, for they also agreed there is a need to clean up the list. Why clean up the list? Was there something dirty in the list? The problem is there were allegations that gardeners, school teachers, any other person is on the list. Therefore, the process was to say we would then do this exercise independently and ensure that there is a central list of insolvency practitioners. When information was gathered at the beginning, the numbers reflected that countrywide you have plus minus 1,280 practitioners of insolvency. When the applications were extended, that people must submit the information, their information, and that information amongst others, because we are existing and are part of the government, we had to realize that there's also a need that practitioners must submit their good standing in terms of their tax, as well as their bodies to which they belong. They were to give out their tax clearance certificate with the information they submit, so that at least this allocation of work to them will ensure that the treasury receives what's due from them as well. So, in that process, one of the qualification criteria that was required was that there be either a four-year degree, law degree, or a commerce degree. We were mindful of the fact that there were people with vested rights, people who had previously practiced and are still active in a practice, who have acquired the right to practice in this area or in this industry. We could not just come and say tomorrow they are no longer now allowed. So we had to, in a way, adopt and accept the grandfather clause insofar as only those who are active that have a sufficient a qualification, be it a diploma, that's the only exception. However, the four-year law degree or commerce degree plus the information that reflects the experience plus an essential aspect. Now, the total respondents whose information and qualification met the criteria to date, we have published and indicated that there are 485 practitioners who are in good standing. Now, to answer the question of the chair relating to the young, new female practitioners who are graduates who are having these degrees, we, excluding the 485, have interviewed more than 110 of these. We are still continuing. So we have also cleared with our offices where people would not perhaps communicate and understand the process that it was happening. It was centralized. It was not stopped at all. So every time when we get a question where people say, I'm told that the master's list is closed, people are not coming on the list. We have said no. This process is centralized. It's happening at the office of the chief master. We have thus far got a sense that of the 110, about 99 of them ought to have made it through the screen. Because if they are new, how do you determine surely that they can or they have the requisite knowledge and understanding? You, other than see their documentation, just come and inquire on the basic questions that one expects of a practitioner to know so that one understands in what area of field he or she is getting into. So we have at least, if you add the 485 to 99, it's closer to 584. We indicate to those who didn't make it that it is not a final or that's closed for them. They just need to go and refresh, get some additional information, further training and mentoring, and the opportunity will continue to be open perhaps in the new year. We can't just not have pre-arranged programs of when the interviews will take place. But as for now, it is still ongoing, and I believe my colleagues even today are interviewing some. They've scheduled something like 7 people to be interviewed today. So the process is ongoing here, and we are in it. If I were also to give the indication on the numbers from the 485, just from the male and female, is that the total female is 166 out of the 485, whereas 319 male. So the industry is male dominated. We are indeed trying to transform and hopefully expect that with time the number of female practitioners will increase.
What I don't understand about it is if a person has the law degree or that commercial degree for you, they are admitted as an accountant or admitted as an attorney and they have an insolvency degree, what would be the purpose of the interview? And secondly, Advocate Dasson, if the surety is required, for a new entrant, it would be very difficult for any bank to give them any money. So effectively, they will be excluded on the basis of disqualification to a first capital. So we are back to the same problem that the banks and trusts have previously disadvantaged people, and they will think that they will go and mess up the estate, and therefore they will lose the money. Is there not thinking perhaps that in the same way that the attorneys have a fidelity fund, that a fund be established which would support the new entrant? Otherwise, this transformation will not make any sense of the practical.
Chair, can I give the House
the
assurance that the fund of security is not normally provided by banks. There's an insurance industry that's very well organized that provides the security, and they have been on the track record allowing quite a number of new people. Of course, they set stringent criteria because allowing a person into the position of trust really brings a risk, and the risk is offset. I am not aware of people that have applied for the bonds of security, what they call a facility, that have been refused. I know that there are quite some stringent steps that such a new practitioner might have to build a proper support in actually delivering the services. But I can assure you we are in constant communication with the insurance industry regarding this, and that we've not been made aware of people who have found that to be a frustration. As a matter of interest, if the fund has to be set up, it is estimated that the annual value of matters in liquidation is around 160 billion rand. It would be quite a fund to set up from scratch. So there is this existing practice, several insurance companies that are providing the services, and they are well structured into an organization that we liaise with on a very regular basis. Of course, they are aware of our policy, and of course, they are raising with you the concerns of how can we trust such a person without the proven record. And we have said to them, well, we have seen for ourselves that your fears have not been proven correct yet. That many, many young black female practitioners have raised to a level where one can say that it does not pose any more risk than any other practitioner.
Thank you.
Just a general question regarding the necessity of the interview. We believe that particularly people who have the degree and who have gone through the diploma course will surely make it with ease in the interview. What may be a bit of a challenge for many people could be just the detailed information that we require them to complete in the information form. But I was closely working with the team that was conducting the interviews. I had looked at the level at which they pitched the question, and we are all in agreement that in many instances, people who have the 4-year law or commercial degree, and even more so those who have gone for a diplomacy diploma certificate would make it with you. I think the challenge more on the review that has made it is either people who did not make it, maybe they just were fearing or scared with the concept of the interview, and it's not a long interview. We say to them, we really just test the basics that necessarily needs to be there. So I think, and because of the fact that we are not saying they are not going to be readmitted or given an opportunity to try again the next time, we believe that it will not defeat the objective. Looking at the ratios from 110, if we make 100 of them make it through this test an indication that the substantial number can.
Fujian, with respect, to me, it appears you want people to pass twice. Because, if you look at the disadvantaged communities, these kids go and get qualifications and end up cleaning cars for 10 years or 5 years because they don't get anything. So when you go to interview them, it depends on where you call them, and they're not surprised anything. I passed I'm a trick math. But right now, if you can test me on some 6 maths, I won't pass. I've forgotten those. But if you say, on the basis of the fact that you once passed maths, you will qualify here, but maybe you need a refresher course. That's why I was asking the question about something like the Justice College. I think we need people to get a refresher course other than test them on what they passed. Because I can tell you, I also passed agriculture. But right now, I don't remember anything. But if you give me a book for a week, I can advise, I can do that. So I would really wrong you right to think that you need to maybe review that approach. As you correctly say, others would even get scared because they were waiting at a petrol station and suddenly you want to ask them other questions.
Our sales responsibility to look into the matter and come back to the house with possible steps that we could and have implemented in that regard, especially when when we get feedback on the upcoming litigation. Thoughts that come to my first-class commitment at this point in time might be to ask the Practitioners Association to set up a special training effort around people who did not make it and people who feel they might need to come and get basic skills in the area. I don't want to commit that. I only commit to taking it up with the skilled practitioners and see to what extent we can address the very important issue that you are raising, growing timber, so to speak, for the longer term. I can only make that undertaking to you.
Lastly, let me say that I have interacted with your office in Durban. I think you have a very efficient staff. The office is well run. And I told them one day that I met you, I'll tell you that they're very good. But you know, what worries me there is the place is a rural area. And the queues are so long. And they have to close early in the afternoon. And people have got to go back. And now to come back is expensive. I don't know how that can be addressed, if you can understand that matter. But you have a committed staff that are compassionate and they treat people very well. But I think the difficulties are things that are not within their control.
Jeff, thank you very much for that feedback. I think those are the values that we all aspire to and are committed to deliver. As far as Kulakwini is concerned, we are ready to move into the new High Court, most likely in the region of January 2015, which will seek to more space. But we are similarly setting up a sub-office in Nebo, for the people of that area need not travel all the way to Kulakwini. And we are looking in possibilities also at other closer to the people setup. But the staffing component for the Nebo intervention has been approved. So with our IT systems and staffing in Nebo, at least some of the people in the queue need not to travel that far. We are committed towards expanding our services to the rural, especially in the Nebo area. I want to give the House assurance that when the Gazette Department report back, we will have more on our effort to decentralize our services. And we hope to continue in that spirit of really caring for the people. Of course, in the Masters, we deal with criminal environment, we deal with really things. And we want people to do what you've seen there and duplicate that attitude. We will come back with more information on what we've done, not to bring the people into Kulakwini, but to try and help people with that.
Lastly, Advocate, we are aware that the Department of Justice has lots of vacancies. We are also aware that there is even an organization of unemployed graduates. Now, we would be interested to know whether these unemployed graduates are unemployable by the department, and whether in your case there's nothing that can be done for these unemployed graduates. Also, if we could get a report after you have the interviews of the people that qualified and those that did not qualify, and so that we can see whether if they don't qualify in your case, are they similarly not qualifying in other areas of the Department of Justice? Because, you know, our democracy is something that is very important, and we can lose it unless we treat some of these matters as urgent matters. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, I wonder if I speak of records, how many of the House will understand. But we have a saying that says, as the cat berges the mouse bars. If the cat is out of the house, the mouse is keen around. So in the absence of the DG, I do not want to speak on the spot. The cat might come back and give me a good strength. But I do give the house the assurance that in terms of an employee, in the master's environment, that's from 1st of August, July, we have 100 unemployed people on an intern basis in the master's alone. On your question, if I'm a qualified person with no experience and cannot answer the questions at the interview, does it mean such a person is not employable in the master's environment? I want to give the house the assurance that if I walk into the master's environment, I don't know nothing. And I then, in my job, we want to do so and recruit people and empower them. Maybe one day also to be a chief master with knowledge from the institution. We do not come. The only reason why we set these higher standards is because such a person will be given full access to another person's livelihood, their assets, their interests. We have a responsibility towards creditors not to lower the interest level too low. That's why we will in our report and say how we dealt with those people in retraining and empowerment environment. If on the issue of vacancies and employment, I can just ask the house permission through the discipline of the DG to proper answer for that.
Your DG has a clear cut. She gave us a very good report. And even our knowledge of the vacancies came from her. It's not something that we picked from the industry. But we are really very proud of the work that we have been doing. So we don't want to prosecute you. We want to assist you because we think you are doing good work. You deserve our support. Thank you very much, and enjoy your weekend. We were scared that you will be scared of entering the premises of Parliament because of the hooliganism that took place yesterday. Thank you for having confidence in their security at this premises.
It's a flag cup.
What's